Good morning. We're going to open an informational hearing for the Higher Ed and Economic Development Subcommittee. Got a busy schedule here, so we're going to jump right into it. We want to wish Representative Chair Harker the best as he is suffering in Australia and has left the heavy lifting to us. And so, Senator, good morning and good to see you. We're going to jump right into you here. So John, if you want to come on up and have a seat.
Sure. Thank you so much.
And we want to welcome, if you see a new face at the end of the dais down here, it's Representative Barbara Smith Warner. Her swearing in is this afternoon at 1:30. Is that correct?
Yep.
All righty. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about who you replace and what you're doing here.
Sure. I am replacing Representative Dembro, who is now Senator Dembro, from Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose, just a few miles up north of here. And I will be replacing him on all of his committees, and I'm thrilled to be here to learn about what this committee is doing and just kind of take in as much as I can between now and the end of the short session.
Excellent. Well, we always encourage new members to take their cues from Representative Gilliam.
This really is the standard.
Anyway, welcome, Barbara.
Thank you.
And I want to announce that Representative Gallegos is taking the position of vice chair, and as we're kind of moving chairs around, so thank you for taking on that responsibility. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I would like to just point out that upon assuming the gavel, this committee began to meet at a much more reasonable hour. So,
did you like that?
I like that, so I'm all in favor of you maintaining the control of that gavel, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would like to reiterate what Representative Johnson said. It's an excellent time. Excellent.
Well, thank you. I aim to keep you guys happy, so we're off on the right foot. The agenda today, we're going to go a little bit out of order so that we can get the Senator on her way. But after that, then, we're going to hear a proposal on legislation from ETIC, and then a progress report on House Bill 3079 work group, an update from the Special Committee on University Governance, and then we'll have a work session on introducing some committee measures. There are three of them. And then we'll take a couple of minutes each on, I think there are going to be two other member bills just to present and get out in the air there. So any questions before we jump right in? We're all good? Except for Representative Gilliam, we're all good. Okay. I'm going to open an informational hearing on something here that Senator Steiner Hayward's going to tell us about. So totally prepared. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Hoffman, Vice Chair Gallegos, and members of the committee. And if I may, I would like to start by welcoming Representative Smith Warner and saying that I empathize completely. I was installed 2 years ago on January 5th, and this was Legislative Days in January. It was my first introduction to the legislature. If you feel like standing under Niagara Falls, it's normal, and let me know how I can help. And welcome to the Two-Name Club. For the record, I'm Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, another member of the Two-Name Club. I'm State Senator from District 17, which is Northwest Portland, unincorporated Multnomah, Washington County, and part of Beaverton, also a ways north of here. And I'm here today to testify about the Loan Forgiveness Program. As some of you may be aware, in the 2011 session, this body approved funding of $525,000 for the 11-13 biennium for a program designed to promote healthcare professionals going to practice in rural areas, and developed this program that was administered through the Office of Rural Health as previous loan repayment programs. And I think most of you are familiar with the difference. Loan forgiveness is kind of a grow-your-own program where we engage with students in healthcare professional programs. Loan repayment is when we take people who are already ready to go into practice and invite and then offer to repay some of their loans in exchange for them practicing for a designated period of time in a rural or urban underserved area. So we developed this loan forgiveness program in the 11-13 biennium that was targeted at students on very specific rural training tracks in any health professional program, post-baccalaureate level health professional program, so PA, nurse practitioner, MD, or DO program in the state, that was working with the Office of Rural Health and could demonstrate that they had an appropriate rural training program. And then the student would have their loans forgiven over a period of time in exchange once they were practicing in accepted areas after they got out of their full training. In the 2013 session, this legislature approved a total of $1 million in funding for that program, which was a wonderful expansion and not sufficient. Despite the fact that in the for the 13-15 biennium, we now have $7.5 million in total funding for loan repayment and loan forgiveness programs of one type or another, and the fact that that is double the total amount we've put into these programs over the preceding 20 years, that's still not sufficient. We have an enormous healthcare workforce shortage in this state, and it will only get worse. We now have 170,000 more people who have health insurance as of January 1st, and that number will continue to grow. They need access to primary care. It's a particular shortage in our rural communities, and as a family physician who is previous president of the Oregon Academy of Family Physician, I'm well aware of the challenges my rural colleagues face in recruiting partners, whether that be nurse practitioners or PAs or other physicians, to practice with them in these rural areas, in part because you get paid less to practice in those areas, and yet your debt doesn't get decreased. So having less debt when you come out of school, first of all, helps students choose primary care specialties, whether that's general internal medicine or general pediatrics or family medicine, which tend to be lower reimbursed specialties in the first place because they're more confident that their debt burden will be relieved once they go into practice, and it allows them to choose to locate in traditionally underserved parts of our state, which is a critical of importance to maintaining the economies in rural Oregon, which is a very high priority for me, because if you don't have an adequate healthcare presence in a community, no employer in their right mind wants to locate a business there. Furthermore, we know that every physician in a community generates on average $1 to $2 million in economic activity per year. That's a lot, people. That's five to seven living wage jobs per provider. So having these programs in place, these loan forgiveness programs in particular, where we target Oregon students in Oregon health professional programs, it's a grow-your-own program that keeps Oregon kids, these programs in-state, doing the kinds of health care that we need them to do. It's a huge benefit to Oregonians. Ultimately, these programs have proven very successful nationwide. This legislature expressed its confidence in the program by doubling the funding almost in this biennium compared to the 11-13 biennium, and I urge you to give serious consideration, and we'll be doing that obviously in my Ways and Means side as well, to increasing the funding and making sure that we can expand it to all eligible students in every healthcare professional program across the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Springer, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just a little bit I want to add to this, because the senator did a great job of explaining the program, explaining how it works, how it's funded, and the need. I want to share with you a brief story. As many of you know, several years ago, I lived in John Day. Loved it over there. That was my first cop job. It was a different world, let me tell you. But I loved being there. But I remember going over there, and one of the first things I did is go see our local guy who was our only dentist, or actually the only full-time dentist we had, and got to know him. And then it was time to go find a doctor. That was rather difficult. And times were better then in Grant County than they are now. And I can't tell you the status today, but Representative Huffman, I bet you can, of exactly how many primary care providers there are in John Day. And there was a time there was none. There was none. And you ask yourself, well, why? It's a great community. It's beautiful. There's all sorts of recreational opportunities. The reality is they couldn't pay the bills. And I remember we did have one doc there for a while. Great guy, fun guy. I don't know if he was directly out of med school, because I didn't pay attention. Didn't matter. I assumed everywhere I went, there would be a doctor. I assumed. That's not a fair assumption anymore. And so I remember that this particular doc had his young family, and he started buying some businesses in Prairie City and trying to restore them, and he did. It made sense. Long story short, couldn't make a go of it and left. He was trying to supplement his income so he could stay because he wanted to do rural health care, but he couldn't pay his debt, and he couldn't support his family, and he left. And this is a guy that plugged into the community, and that's what happens in our rural areas with primary health care providers. They come in, and they plug in, and they become part of the community, and that's what we want. The reality is they can't come and pay the bills. They can't come and pay the bills. And one of the things I like particularly about this is the establishment of the rural track. Some places do that, some places don't. This isn't about, certainly I don't want this to be about, if you go and hang out your shingle for 4 years here, we'll help pay your bills. No, I want this to be a program that says, here's a community for you to invest in, and here's the nuances, here's the different pieces that occur in rural areas with healthcare and you being a member, a vital member of the community. And so that is a couple pieces of this. Of course, $2.5 million is great. I think $5 million would be great, too. But we do need to be realists. So I highly encourage you in supporting this bill. It makes sense. It makes sense. There's safeguards. There's sideboards in place. If a commitment isn't carried out, then it's dealt with appropriately. So I don't, like I said, I think the center did a great job of explaining what it does. This is absolutely vital. I know people that have left their communities because they can't receive the health care they need. And anybody that knows me knows I'm all about small towns, and there's lots of pieces that go into that. Mm-hmm. And that's what my district is. And we've got to provide a way for them to have adequate health care. They're not second-class citizens. They're not. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you guys taking the time to come. I'm very supportive of the bill, as you know, and wanted to give you a chance to get it out on the table, and best of luck in February. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Chair.
Question?
Real quick.
Representative.
This is a placeholder, because a lot of things you and the representative talked about, I agree with, but it's not in the bill. So you're going to have to put some of these requirements in here. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, this bill, as I understand it, would simply add funding to an existing program that has well-established criteria. It would not be intended to create a new program. If it is, then I've misunderstood the intent. I think it's intended to just add funding to an existing, well-defined, well-established program. That was my understanding.
Just a quick follow-up.
And we are dealing with legislative concept 45, clarify.
To be honest, I haven't read the entire legislative concept, but
it's brief.
Thank you.
It's brief. So, yeah.
Okay.
Follow-up, Representative?
Well, I think after you look at that, there may be something else we want to add to this, because this doesn't clarify that, I don't think, to me. So,
I will. Thank you for pointing that out to me, Representative. I will definitely take a look at it. My hope would be that this would simply add funding. I know that when we heard testimony about this in the 13th session, it was very clear from the Office of Rural Health that they were already engaged with half to two-thirds of the potentially eligible healthcare professional programs, and we're in serious conversation with the other ones, including our new school, or relatively newer school of osteopathic medicine in Lebanon, which I strongly support having a program, and I know they're working on establishing a rural track. They've got one at Pacific for their PA program. I think they've got one at University of Portland for their NP program. So the Office of Rural Health, I think, has been historically doing a good job of outreach, I didn't realize about the John Day connection. I practiced out there for 3 months when I was a resident, so I love John Day, too.
So I think good feedback, though, Representative. We want to make sure it's
clarification, Mr. Chair. I think that what we're hearing today, and I agree with the speaker's program, that representatives are coming in introducing their bill, but this is not going to be a committee bill. We're not going to vote on anything.
Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Just an introduction. So with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on LC 45.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to open up a informational hearing on ETIC and invite Eric Meslow up. Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
And I know that was a very poor introduction, so I knew you'd tell us exactly who you are and what you do.
I'll do that.
And Eric is about 15 minutes roughly going to be satisfied.
Yeah.
Okay.
If I do my job, yes. Chair Huffman, Vice Chair Gallegos, my name is Eric, I'm members of the committee. My name is Eric Meslow. I reside in Tualatin, Oregon. I'm the president and CEO of TimberCon, Inc. However, I'm here today as the chair of the Engineering Technology Industry Council, otherwise known as ETIC, which I am here to support Legislative Concept 177. Before we get started, I wanted to give a little background history. I know we have new members of the committee. I have spoken to this committee a number of times over ETIC over the last 8 years, but a little background I think is a good place to start. ETIC was formed in 1997 in response to a dramatic delta between the demand for technology employees and the supply the state was producing. ETIC's council is made up of voting members from industry, who are aided by professional educators and make strategic investments in the technology and engineering programs at the 7 public universities plus OHSU. The dollars are invested are meant to be value-added and extremely focused in meeting industry needs. ETIC therefore requires the schools to align those investments and to be matched by private and federal dollars. ETIC is also responsible for tracking the state's investment, ensuring compliance, and meeting the state's ever-changing priorities. The current status of ETIC is interesting. Like many things in higher ed, it's somewhat in flux. The current oversight of ETIC resides in the Chancellor's office. Current oversight of ETIC resides in the Chancellor's office. ETIC submits its recommendations to the Chancellor and the State Board of Higher Education for approval. Accountability for those results are to the Board of Higher Education. OUS provides also part-time executive director as well as part-time administrative support as well as office space for ETIC. This has been an excellent arrangement, and the industry has been had a tremendous working relationship with OUS over the past 16 years. And I may add, it's a relatively unique relationship within the university system. Our challenge today is obviously that OUS is somewhat in flux, needless to say, and ETIC needs a new administrative home. The reason this requires your time today is that ETIC's original legislative language specifically defined in the statute called out the Chancellor specifically as our oversight. And seeing that there's most likely not going to be a Chancellor in the future, we need to make a change. ETIC Council has reviewed, debated, and discussed different paths with the critical stakeholders over the last 9 months. And we then briefed Representative Parker on the challenges and possible solutions to this in the third quarter of this year. And Representative Parker's office in the Legislative Council formulated the legislative concept that you see in front of you today as LC 177.
And Eric, if I can interrupt,
yes,
just so members understand that this is one of the three committee bills that we will be addressing toward the end of the meeting today to adopt as a committee bill.
Thank you. Legislative Concept 177 is very simple, basically. It directs ETIC to submit, instead of to the Chancellor and to the Board of Higher Education, our reviews and proposals. Instead, we would propose that it, we report directly to the Chief Education Officer and the Oregon Education Investment Board, the OEIB. This is, can be found in Section 1, Paragraph 5 of the Legislative Concept. We further provide that ETIC's oversight shall remove to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission when the OEIB sunsets in, I believe it's 2016, I believe, March of 2016. The last two changes are very much just language to call out the timing of those two events.
What did he just say? Would you repeat that?
No.
Representative, could you just repeat?
Okay, no problem. The three or four major changes in the legislative concept to the original statute is that ETIC will report to the Chief Education Officer, as opposed to the chancellor, that ETIC's oversight will then move to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission when the OEIB sunsets in 2016. And then the last two changes are simply the language around those dates in regards to March 15th, 2016, the sunset date, I believe, of OEIB, and then this act taking effect in July 1st of 2014 if passed. Did I answer your questions, Representative Greenlick?
Yeah, I just didn't hear what you said, but my question is, why don't you go to the heck right now?
I've got the next slide. The logic and reasoning to our decision-making process is was widely debated for many, many months. This was not taken lightly. And this is a recommendation coming directly from the ETIC Council and industry. This was not influenced by the parties or plank holders that possibly could have been our solutions. ETIC believes this is going to be a temporary solution. It is budget neutral as well. ETIC carries its own budget. And OIB has significant synergy with ETIC's mission in the fact that strategic investments are met to make specific individual needs. And more importantly, the STEM Council, which was created in the last legislative session, resides under the OEIB. And we believe that as the STEM Council investigates and looks at the environment, the STEM environment, ETIC very well much will most likely have a change of status in the next 12 to 18 months, where we'll align and work much closer with the STEM Council. And since the STEM Council is in the OEIB, we figured that that would be a better location. Also, the broad and top-line oversight of the OEIB fits traditionally a little bit tighter with us. And as well, we want to give the HEC an opportunity to form, get their top line agenda concrete before we would move to them. OIB, having been in place for a period of time, we believe is in a much more an easier place for us to go right now. Now, we have spoken with all the critical people, Dr. Nancy Golden, who I believe is here in the room, and and Ben Cannon from the HEC, as well as Dr. Melody Rose, the current chancellor, have all been briefed on this, and I believe we have support from all three of those people. Again, this is a proposal. The question of why we're not going to the HEC as opposed to the OEIB is one that we batted around for a good solid 9 months. So I can't emphasize enough that this one's been worked on for a lot. So ultimately, that's the end of my presentation. I can answer any questions if you have them.
Further questions? Eric, you did well.
Very well.
And it was kind of dark, so I didn't see the nodding of heads from the three that you.
I know I didn't realize the three were going to be in the room. It's good to see that they're here. Again, I want to make one very major point. This is most likely temporary. This is an administrative move. We believe there's going to be dramatic changes in the STEM environment over the next 2 years as the STEM Council comes up to speed, and there are going to be a lot of dynamic changes in the near future. So I really believe this will work its way out within the next 18 months or so.
All right. Thank you, Eric. Appreciate
you.
Your time, as always. I'm going to close the informational hearing on LC-177, and we're going to open an informational hearing on House Bill 3079, Work Group Progress. And I said that without looking to see if Senator Dimbrough is in the room. Not outside the door. Yeah, let's try to suspend it or leave it open. Okay. We're going to leave that informational hearing open, and we'll, when Senator Dimbrough shows up, we'll get back to that. Representative Johnson, would you be prepared at this point to go ahead and give us a quick presentation on the member concept that you've got coming up?
I can do that, Mr. Chair. You bet. Thank you
and
very
much. I guess I will open a Representative Johnson session here.
Thank you very much. Members, I believe you had in front of you some information that came from my office on my letterhead that has some relevant information on a bill that we intend to have for you this session. I think all of us that have been on this committee over the past few years, and as long as I've been in the legislature, I've sat on House Higher Ed, have been impacted by the studies of or the information about student debt, i.e. tuition, and just the cost of higher ed and the impact that that's having on students. And I think much of our work that we've already seen today is made focused on addressing that topic. So various states have are in the progress of trying to address this as well. I've had the opportunity to travel and attend many different conferences across the country over the past few years, and again, wrestling with the concept of debt, the cost of degrees, and so forth is a relevant topic everywhere. And various states are approaching this in certain ways. And I've included some information in your packet what certain states, i.e. Texas, have tried to do, Florida has tried to do, Wisconsin's in the process of trying to do some things. And some of you may have heard the concept of a quote-unquote 10KBA that is kind of rhymes, but it's again, it's an effort to try to get to a known commodity, i.e. a degree, at a fixed cost so that students understand what the outlay will be, and usually this fixed cost, this 10K, is significantly less than what the market rate would be for a comparable degree at that institution or within that system. So various states have attempted to do this in various ways. Many of Texas and Florida both have gone down this road because the governor has said, I want a 10KBA in this state. And then the legislature has gone to work to try to enact that. And I will mention, and you'll see it in your handout here, with varying degrees of success, i.e. sometimes you can say, thus shall there be one, and it happens, and other times it doesn't quite work that way. But here in Oregon, what we're proposing and what this bill will be about is to work with our regionals and our tech-focused institution, too, OIT, and allow them to collaborate with the HEC to come up with a degree pathway, a known commodity fixed cost pathway for at least two degrees within their institution that would be at a fixed cost that would be significantly less than what the average rate would be, your going rate for the tuition would be for the degree, and to create a pilot, okay, to work with the HEC, have the HEC collaborate with them in putting this together. They would report to the legislature sometime before the end of 2014 with the idea that these degrees would be operable and ready for prime time in the fall of 2015 for that academic year. So each institution, there'd be four institutions, Western, Eastern, and OIT, and Southern, would each have at least two degree pathways, one of which needs to be tied to their mission of their institution, what is it that they're, you know, focused on, and the other one needs to be tied to the needs of the private sector within that region so that there's direct connection to job availability, to private sector development, and so forth as well. And to be able to pilot these, and with the idea, too, that they would be a sustainable pathway. And hopefully, if the pilot is successful, that at the end of 5 years, there could be ways to increase the numbers of degrees that would be available across the state of Oregon as well. So we chose to focus and work with the regionals, if you will, recognizing that our other institutions now with their institutional boards hopefully will be engaged in equally fruitful efforts to increase the scope and scale of their missions. We've had conversations throughout the course of the last few months and several months, actually, with the presidents of all the institutions involved. They're aware of what we're working on. We'll continue to talk with them this week as well. So we're excited about it, but again, it's just an attempt to do something, again, to provide for Oregon's students out there of all levels and age groups and so forth, ways to get to degree completion at a lesser rate in a known commodity, a known time frame, and allow the universities then to examine all of the different ways that they could offer reduced cost, i.e. through dual accreditation, proficiency-based credit, so forth and so on. What could we do to put together a package that's going to allow students to get to completion, to get that job that they need and that Oregon needs to have them occupy within a quick fashion. So that's it.
Super. Thank you.
Thank you.
Best of luck. Sounds good. Going to close the informational hearing on... And right after Representative Greenlick's question, I'm going to close the Representative Johnson hearing.
Very short question. Would that pathway lead through community colleges?
It could. You know, we've obviously in Oregon there already are some tracks to run on, i.e. the Eastern Promise that you're familiar with, where there's been some great collaboration between the whole public education realm in that part of the state. And there are some trackways through high school to community colleges to completion at the university. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the question.
Now I'm going to close the informational hearing on Representative Johnson and invite Senator Denborough up. And we already have a hearing open, so, sir, introduce yourself and take it away.
Good morning, ladies and honorable gentlemen. I'm Michael Denborough, State Senator, District 23, Northeast, Southeast Portland. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to see you all. Happy New Year. And I'm here with representing one of my kind of lingering responsibilities from my time with you, and that's the work on what was last session House Bill 3079. You'll remember that House Bill 3079 was a combination of two bills, one of which I was a sponsor of, the other Representative Johnson was a sponsor of, and both of them had to do with coming up with a way of making it easier for students and their families, prospective students and their families, to make smart decisions about what is the right college or university for them, what is going to be the college or university that is going to best meet their needs, and to give them that information in a way where they can do sort of side-by-side comparative analysis. You know, looking at things like the cost of the program, how successful the programs are in terms of, you know, what kind of debt load they're putting on their students, how many of their students are defaulting on their loans. All of this information that we were thinking about collecting and making available to students is information that's being reported, and that's the goal of this. It's being reported to national, to the federal Department of Education, or, you know, to the state, certainly in the case of the for-profit institutions where the state regulates them. But this information is going, but it's not really easily accessible for students. And so what we wanted to do was to create sort of information sheets and have them in a way where the students could, you know, as I say, have easy access to them. We started working on this last year. We had a work group that included several representatives that were interested in this issue, representatives of the for-profit sector, the nonprofit university sector, the public university and community college sector, to work on this. We were not able in the last session to get everything worked out. We wound up with a dash four amendment. But at the end of the day, you know, I think what we have, what you have before you as a legislative concept, is essentially was the best shot of the work group. Essentially, very similar to the dash four amendments, and you know, one of the issues that led us to hold back on putting it forth was, you know, that the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission is going to have a role to play, obviously, in helping to collect this information, to put it in a place where it's all together, where we know we're dealing with apples and apples, where when the reporting requirements to the feds change, there can be adjustments to this so it can reflect that. And, you know, if you'll recall back at the, it wasn't until the very end of the 13th session that we had a sense of what the budget and hence the capacity of the HEC was going to be going forward. And the you know, with the ultimate funding of the HEC, I think it will have the capacity to handle this. To be honest, it may not really have the capacity until July of 2015, you know, until the beginning of the next biennium when it's putting together its budget, you know, for the next biennium. So we may want to consider holding off on the, the final implementation of this until July of 2015. But, you know, that I think is something for further discussion. So that in a nutshell is you know, where I think we are at this point, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any really tough questions for the senator?
I'll be easy.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Just curious to see, I mean, there obviously were during the work group a lot of different stakeholders involved. Do you have a pulse for how the various entities feel about what the final product? I mean, I know there was kind of a collaborative effort and so forth. Work group met once or twice during the interim. Wasn't a great deal of collaboration,
no.
But just wondered about where, from your perspective, where is everybody right now?
From all indications, you know, the DASH, when we sought feedback, and I don't know, Victoria maybe can help me with this, but when we sought feedback, I think what we heard, the only feedback that we got was that, you know, the DASH 4 is where we left it, was the acceptable place to be. And is that what you recall, Victoria?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's mm-hmm. what made us decide, let's just go forward with this. And, you know, if further work needs to be done, we can perhaps look at it between now and February. Obviously, we're on a fast track with this. But again, I think that these information sheets will not be produced overnight. But what passing this legislation will do is it will make it very clear that this is something the state wants to see done, and for that work, for the HEC to coordinate that work. I think it's really going to be important for Oregon and for students and families to have this tool as they're doing their analyses. And in conversations I've had with our national higher ed associations, people are very interested in it. And there may actually be a potential for some private funding even to help with the creation of a website that, you know, through the HEC that would, you know, really make it easy for students to do one-stop shopping on this issue.
Representative.
Would this impact only public schools in the state?
No. This is this would be all.
Okay.
And that, I think, is the beauty of it, frankly, is that, you know, the student wanted to go into graphic design, let's say, you know, they would, you know, be able to look at all the schools that offer graphic design in their area and around the state and, you know, really be able to do some side-by-side looking. You know, right now they may get that information from the school that they're interested in attending, but then they have to go to the other school and the other school and the other school. I mean, ideally, I think we were interested in getting to a point where it's really easy to do a side-by-side sort of look.
I see nothing else, sir. Thank you. That was LC 173, which is number two on our list of committee bills that we'll be having a work session on shortly. Senator Denborough, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
it's great
coming.
To see you all again.
Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing on LC 173, and I am going to open an informational hearing with Representative Gallegos and present a concept that he has.
Well, come down.
Certainly.
I'd like to see your reactions.
Easy to throw tomatoes.
Representative Johnson, what was the LC number on your...
93, I believe.
93? Okay.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Yes.
Great. Chair Huffman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify today. I want to take a brief moment to talk about LC 104, which seeks to establish the Aspirations to College program. In the 2013-15 governor's recommended budget, there was over $70 million was identified for strategic investment in education, and that was for pre-K, STEM education, dual credit, K-12 mentoring, Eastern Promise to CTE programs. Last session, our committee unanimously passed House Bill 3232 and 3233, creating those strategic investments, which included $2.5 million for community college and workforce development for aspirations to college programs. Unfortunately, at the end of the session, that money was not allocated to this policy that we had unanimously supported, and so no money was extended. This bill that I'm talking about today and presenting is we're calling the Aspirations to College Bill, requests a funding restoration of $1.5 million. So that's a restoration, not a new request, but a restoration of the $1.5 million to be used for higher education workforce development pilot programs across Oregon. These funds will be allocated through $1.5 million pilot project for the remainder of the biennium to create a competitive grant program available to community colleges throughout the state for programs providing access and support to students from low-income and first-generation communities. The goal is to leverage, and this is one of the aspects that I really like about this bill, the goal is to leverage our state investment by partnering with local business communities, the philanthropic communities, and local governments to provide these students a chance to go to college, but also to meet our 40-40-20 objectives and thrive. So I do want to mention in my own district, Washington County, there's a Future Connect program sponsored by Portland Community College and their partnership with the cities of Beaverton and Hillsboro. Through that program, we supported a cohort of approximately 100 students through their first semester of college and has helped them to plan their terms ahead. Students are guided through their FAFSA, which is sort of that first hurdle of college. They're required to take a college success course, which is covered by the scholarships, and work one-to-one with success coaches. And I want to highlight this program because they have, like in this program specifically, they had like a 97% retention rate, which is pretty awesome. And again, this really shouldn't just be happening in my district. It should be happening in every district. So, you know, I could go on with my own personal story about getting through community college and how that really helped me. And you know, we want to make sure that it's an opportunity that's available to as many folks as we can, particularly first-generation, low-income folks. But, you know, I just want to close by saying that our economic imperative, it is our economic imperative that the next generation of Oregonians has access to college and the workforce training skills to help our communities thrive and create a more prosperous Oregon. Yeah, it's a great little bill, so I do hope we all support it again.
Thank you, Representative. Questions?
Any questions?
Representative Greenlee.
I'd just like to make a comment rather than a question. We're focusing more and more attention in our society about the income disparity, about the growing disparity between high and low. And in my generation, the university system was a way to move up, to have an opportunity chance. And that opportunity is really fading for a lot of our young people. I say it's really important to do things like this to get very early into that and get these young people understand there is a way to move up. There, you know, the American dream is not dead. And this sort of thing is exactly the kind of program we need to have to help that along.
Thank you, Representative Green. I agree, and I think that, again, this is about the third time we've heard about this particular effort in this program, and I think that, again, it really does emphasize the real need to make sure that we get our young people through these programs and into that workforce that so greatly needs Oregonians to be filling our jobs. Thank you very much.
Other questions? I see none. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
going to close the Rep. Gallegos informational hearing. And
kissing him.
Maybe going to the work session,
sure,
since we've got everybody here. And I just
kissing
up.
Yeah, really.
Yep.
Man, big.
I'm going to open up a work session on committee bills, the introduction and acceptance of those. And colleagues, we have three that will be introduced in the motion, and these are committee bills that, again, as always, accepting those as committee bills doesn't mean that you're necessarily in favor of them or will vote for them down the road. It's just to get them into the pipeline. So, Representative Gallegos, do you have a motion?
Sure. Chair Huffman, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 171, dated 12-12-13. LC 173, dated 12-17-13. And finally, LC 177, dated 12-12-13.
Representative Gallegos moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 171, dated 12-12-13. LC 173, dated 12-17-13. And LC 177, dated 12-12-13. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, we haven't heard on 171.
That is true.
We're not going to hear on
171. Trying to be efficient. Representative Buckley and Senator Girard are scheduled at 10. So
we could vote now.
We thought we
would. Testimony.
I thought I would just be efficient. I wasn't sure how tough you would be on me,
it's
Representative.
A placeholder bill anyway.
Yeah, and that one is the one that is the committee placeholder bill. I believe, Victoria, you sent out an email explaining that after that Representative helpful. Johnson had a question. Are there any other questions about that or discussion on any other concepts? Representative Johnson?
Well, I just think it's important to clarify what you were talking about, that draft is just a placeholder that could be the place for some substantive legislation that as of yet isn't before us. So at this point in time, you're just providing a vehicle that doesn't really have any occupants, if you will.
Further discussion?
Doesn't even have a draft.
We could do a gut and stuff. We could put all kinds of stuff in there.
Good stuff.
There you go.
I got one just like that at house.
Seeing and hearing no other real discussion, is there an objection to having these three LCs introduced as committee bills? Seeing none, they are adopted. Close the work session on introduction and acceptance of committee bills. And I'm going to open up an informational hearing with Representative Buckley. We'll name it that. There you are, sir. I'm just scanning the audience and looking all over, and you were right in front of me.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. My co-chair is not here yet, and I'm wondering if I could ask the courtesy of perhaps maybe a break until he gets here.
Sure. We can do that. We're going to take a brief recess.
Till 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Informational hearing on LC 171. Senator Girard, Representative Buckley, welcome. Take it away, whomever wants to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature, and I'm joined by my co-chair on the Interim Committee on University Governance, Senator Girard. When Senator Bates and I do town halls, he lets me go first usually because I do a kind of stream of consciousness on whatever the subject is, and then he comes in behind and cleans it up, makes sure it makes sense, and fills in any holes that I've left. And Senator Girard has graciously allowed me to go for it first today and do the stream of consciousness on the report that we're here to deliver to you on the work on the university governance issues and shared services issues that our committee has been charged to track following the end of the 2013 session. Our committee also has the responsibility to offer recommendations to the legislature, to the governor. Our deadline for that was January 15th. We have informed the legislative leadership and the governor that we need another couple weeks because we meet on Friday with some of the information that has been provided to you now in terms of what has happened in terms of both the governance issue and the shared services issue. In delivering this report, I have to make it very clear, we are not yet speaking for our committee because our committee has not come up with official recommendations. I'm going to try to report to you what has gone on in the last 6 months, and I cannot promise you that I'll be unbiased. I think most of you know, he just laughs. Most of you know I'm a very strong advocate for the regional universities. I live four blocks away from Southern Oregon University. It is the heartbeat of my district. So I am biased in that. So I'm sure Senator Girard will gently correct anything that I say that is not accurate in terms of the work that has happened. And I will talk a little bit, and I'm more than happy in the question and answer period following our discussion to give you further opinions on any part of this. But again, those opinions are mine. They are not the official opinions of our joint committee. In saying all that, I will review very quickly what's happened since we passed Senate Bill 270 and adjourned last July. We're here having this discussion, in my point of view, because of three main things. One, our state has disinvested in higher education over the past two decades plus. When we took on the responsibility for K-12 funding, I'm also talking, I guess, from a budget perspective as well, we took on the responsibility for K-12 funding on the state level, there was not the ability to properly fund both K-12 and higher ed. We've struggled with that ever since. The second issue that we faced is that recession, the hardest recession of our lifetimes, hit in 2008. And knocked our funding for all programs, but particularly for higher ed, way off course. And the third, I would say, and again, this is my opinion, but I think one reason we're here is because the president of the University of Oregon was fired a few years back. And I don't want to go into discussion on that, but that I think that kind of spurred this move that led to Senate Bill 270. And if you're calling Senate Bill 270, the University of Oregon was allowed to go out to have their institutional board, which gives the university the ability to hire and fire the president. And gives the university more latitude in terms of contributions and how they handle their finances, etc. And I believe all of you know that because your interest and involvement with the discussions on Senate Bill 270. Portland State was part of 270, and then Oregon State in the legislation was allowed to make the decision after the bill was passed, and Oregon State has decided to go for the institutional board. If you recall, the regionals in the discussion towards the end of the session, there was concern from the regionals about what their future was going to be, and we were able to put into Senate Bill 270 a path for a discussion on shared services because the impact of the changes from a university system to this separate system was going to have an impact on shared services for all institutions, particularly smaller institutions. And we also provide a path for what's now called the TRUES, the technical and regional universities, to come up with what their recommendation would be for their future governance. So what's happened is the OUS and the Chancellor's Office, which is still operating, the four universities are currently still under the governance of the State Board of Higher Education. The Chancellor's Office is still the entity that is the umbrella group for that four. The Chancellor's Office hired a consultant to consult on governance models, to look at governance models nationwide and come back with a report on governance models nationwide. And the seven institutions engaged as directed into a study of shared services, an analysis of what they are, how much they cost, and what might be a system going forward. Now, the best news I can report to you this morning is that something that I never expected, but the shared services, which was seen as being so incredibly complex, and it is, and seen as incredibly difficult to figure out how we're going to handle the finances, which there is a challenge. But the seven universities were able, through their vice presidents of finance, to come up with a report on shared services, which I think has been distributed to you, that all seven universities agree on. All seven universities agree on, yes, these are the shared services, this is how they evolved, this is what they consist of, and they've all agreed on an approach going forward, an opt-in, opt-out approach. In some ways, it's similar to the discussion we've had on ESDs mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, when if a bigger school district pulls out of an ESD, then what would the smaller school districts do? And so the good news I can give to you is that some tremendous work has been done, and when our committee is going to discuss on Friday whether we can recommend to the legislature and the governor that we support whatever steps need to be taken in statute to bring the opt-in, opt-out into place as their work continues to further define that. So again, I think that's an excellent step forward. Another thing to note on the shared services, that if you look at the numbers behind it, the worst case scenarios really didn't come through. When you look at the totality of shared services, even if there is a total opt-out of one of the major universities, the challenge that we have budget-wise is somewhere around $11 million a year. And when you look at a higher education budget that's in the hundreds of millions of dollars, given the heck of the ability to do some adjustments, $11 million a year, it doesn't seem to be a huge challenge to make adjustments within the higher ed budget, particularly if we as a state are able to start to reinvest in higher education at long last. So shared services, let me just put that to the side for right now because I do think we have a path forward. On the governance issues, it's been much more difficult. I believe you also have been given a link to the consultant's reports on governance. And if again, this is where it might cross over into editorializing, so I want to be clear on it. The reports do not come back with a recommendation. The report comes back with an analysis of the strengths and weaknesses of the different governance models. To begin with, the governance models that were proposed for consideration was a consortium model for all the for the four TRUs to stay together under the similar under the state board, with the board nominated by the governor and approved by the Senate. So basically, keeping status quo was one model that was proposed and looked at. It has strengths, it has weaknesses. Second model was for each of the four to have institutional boards. Similar to the major three universities, larger three universities, they would be able to hire and fire their university president. They would have the same rights and responsibilities as the board members of the larger institutions. And the third model that was studied was, it's called the affiliate model, and it talked about anything from a kind of loose partnership to a branch campus model that would actually have the four one, two, three, or four of the four TRUs operating under the governance of one of the other larger institutions. And what's been discussed, I think you've heard kind of informal conversations about Oregon State University being the university that might look at having branch campuses, having the regionals, one or more of the regionals, be a branch campus for OSU. That discussion has gone on. The intent behind our committee, and it was put in writing in September by the committee co-chairs. We've had shifted around with Senator Denbro going over to the Senate. By the way, I figured that Senator Denbro always wears a sweater and a coat when he talks to you, so I thought I would do the same thing today. I thought that might be the protocol for talking with you. But when Senator Denbro went over to the Senate, Senator Courtney removed himself from the committee and put Senator Denbro on. But the intent of the committee was to have an analysis of these different models and have a data-based decision on which model might be best going forward. And at the same time, leadership, particularly there was a strong push from some members of the legislature for the TRU presidents to actually speed up their work a little bit. The shared service work was moving along. The request was, what is your intent on governance? Please tell us what your desire is sooner rather than later so we have something to work with. So those two things went into play at the same time. Now, I'm going to, this again, I'm cautioning on going to editorial land. The data from the consultant's report, there's nothing that shows that one particular governance model will provide greater sustainability for the regionals or better outcomes. There is nothing in the consultant's report that says that. Each one of the models has strengths and weaknesses. There's no conclusion from the consultant that says Oregon should go in this direction. If you do, you will get a greater ability to sustain your institutions and you'll get better outcomes. Given that the field is somewhat wide open, the true presidents have come back with a proposal, and I've given you a one-pager on it there at the dais. Technical and Regional University proposed governance structure. What they propose is a hybrid structure, taking options number one and two and mixing them. Option number one, consortium, and option number two, having an institution also have a institutional board, each institution. And their thoughts behind this, they will, I'm sure, be happy to talk with each one of you about it, are reflected in this one-pager, but the idea being having the local board gives the ability for the regional universities and their region to participate in the future of their university, to hire and fire their presidents, to engage in fundraising at the levels that they will, and also to be part of a consortium that has the advantages for both shared services, advocacy, budget reasons, etc. That's currently the proposal that's on the table. There have been discussions about the affiliate model, discussions from on the Oregon state side, on the regional side. So far, there's been no proposal set forth on the affiliate model, so I can't report to you a proposal on that. I can report accurately that OSU has not asked for branch campuses, and I can report accurately that the true universities have not asked to be branch campuses. So I can give you that information. And one last note on sustainability, because I don't want to use up all the time, even though I'm tempted to. on sustainability, and again, from my perspective, both as someone who works on the budget and someone who lives four blocks away from a regional university, when the discussion takes place about sustainability, my hope is that it actually takes place within a context of actual funding and actual enrollment. If you look at the enrollment figures from the regional universities, you will see a steady increase in enrollment over the years, just as there's been a steady increase now at the three major universities. More Oregon students are going to college, and that's a positive thing. There have been small blips in enrollment. In fact, SOU, for instance, right now is experiencing some heartache because they had a 5% drop in enrollment this year. It was expected that when the recession ended, there would be a drop in enrollment because we were at record highs. But to give you a context, at SOU, if 45 students don't come back, that's a 1% drop in enrollment. But if you look at the enrollment numbers over time, you will see for each one of the institutions a line that kind of goes like that with some little ups and downs. The difficulty is that the way that we as a state have funded these institutions, those little drops become crises. They become the cause for things like retrenchment, such as happening at SOU right now, where they have to right size again. In that framework, I'd just like to point out, if we had been able to fund the university system at the level we funded in 1999, SOU would not be going through retrenchment. Eastern would not be struggling financially. No one would be struggling financially given that context. In fact, in real dollars, not just for inflation, SOU from the state received $13 million more in 1999 than it's receiving this year when they have close to 1,000 more students than they did in 1999. So the responsibility and sustainability, when people talk about sustainability, I have to push back slightly and say, if, and this is the words of Ed Ray from the Oregon State and the same thing in our committee, if you want to have sustainable institutions, you have to fund them. In the last budget, we were able to get K-12 back closer to where we were before the recession hit, in terms of trying to get some stability and even start to reinvest. In my view, again, my personal view here, we absolutely must do the same for higher ed. If we could get higher ed back to the 2008 level of funding, SOU right now would have an ending balance of 15%. They would not be going through retrenchment, and I doubt we'd be even having a knockdown, drag-out discussion about governance. So I appreciate your indulgence. I appreciate my co-chair's indulgence and my gratitude for letting me go first to frame it in this way, and I look forward to any questions you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Buckley. Are you going to stick around then, and
sure
we'll have questions afterward, if that's okay with everybody? Senator Girod?
I'm Senator Fred Girod. I represent Senate District 9. Our committee really had the assignment of trying to pick up the fallout from Senate Bill 270. We left a lot of open ground, and I think if you look at the regionals or the true colleges, you'll see that we really have created a pretty monumental program, and I really believe it was precipitated by Senate Bill 270. If you look at the four regionals, they're very, very different. Western is not very far away, and it has, you know, it's doing fairly well financially. It's got about a $30 million surplus right now, and it kind of has its niche, if you will, as to who they take. You have OIT, which has done very, very well with the Wilsonville campus, and is very viable in its own right. Then you have two universities that are very close to my heart, but are really struggling. Eastern, which I believe really has a capacity problem in the sense that they're in a location that their draw just is fairly minimal, and they struggle all the time. And then you have Southern, which has its own set of problems, and those are kind of our two problem children, and we're trying to figure out a way to fix the problem. And if you look at shared services, and Representative Buckley said it was about $11 million, it's about $11 million or $12 million, that is actually a cost shift away from the regionals. There were seven areas that we asked for shared services from the big three to go out. And of those, I'm just going to name names. Oregon agreed to three of them. I think Portland State was five and Oregon State was six. So it really, again, precipitated the problem, and we really have to start moving in a direction to correct what we have with these regional universities. Now, Representative Buckley talked about the alternatives and the solutions that we've looked at, and trust me, there's more solutions than there are people on the committee. But it's kind of boiled down to really, I would say, maybe Representative Buckley would disagree, but the hybrid model that was discussed by Representative Buckley and the affiliation model, which I'm going to go into a little bit. The concept behind that is that we would allow Western and OIT to have their own boards with very, very short strings attached. The Eastern and Southern would come under the purview of Oregon State University, but it would be a different concept than a branch campus. It would be Oregon State University at LeGrand. It would be something similar, a cross between University of California at Berkeley and University of California at LA versus a branch campus. It's somewhere in the middle. They would keep their own athletics, but by doing that, we believe that we could increase the draw of those schools so that they could have more enrollment. We'd increase the value of the diploma. I'm an Oregon State grad, so maybe I'm playing politics here, and by doing that we could put them in a little better financial light. That's one model that's being considered. The hybrid model is very much a viable model, and that's where the four universities would have their own boards. But for some of us, that's kind of scary, because when you're having financial problems, it bothers me that bonding and that sort of thing can go on without very much oversight. So our committee really is kind of split between those two models. And maybe there'll be a hybrid. Maybe it'll be one of the other models that we gave you reference to. Excuse me. But those are the two models right now that I see as being viable within the committee. And we're going to take one of those two directions. There is something else that I wanted to bring up, two things. One is Representative Buckley was absolutely correct in funding is we have disinvested in higher ed, and we have to start reinvesting in higher ed. And the rationale for that was we always had somebody to pick up the shortfall And those people were the students, and they pay, compared to what the cost of education was when I went through versus the cost of education now, the average dentist now is between $200,000 and $400,000 in debt. That's just, how do you get out from underneath that? I mean, it's really tough. So I do think that we have to look at increasing funding, which will definitely help the two schools that are struggling. Also, the HEC is in charge of coming up with an outcome-based formula. Now, that outcome-based formula, to me, is probably as much important as the structures that we pick up, because a regional school can't be reimbursed at the same level as the big schools. They just can't. So what we came up with, and Representative Johnson was with me when we were at Colorado, kind of with some of the other state legislatures, were that if we gave so much money across the board initially, and then on top of that have outcome-based funding, mm-hmm. that say 10, 20 million up front, that means a lot more to Eastern and Southern than it does to University of Oregon and Oregon State. Mm-hmm. So it's an equalizer. So the structure of that formula and the well-being of those two schools is extremely important. So that's basically all I have to say. I think Representative Buckley did a good job telling you how tough this is going to be. It's just going to be a tough decision. This is going to be a hot potato, and there is not going to be, there are going to be some hard feelings on this. But I really believe that we need to look at what's best for the state, and I'm a little disappointed that 270 wasn't defined enough that it precipitated this problem. But we are going to work towards what we believe to be solutions, and hopefully Representative Buckley and I can be on the same page. So I'll open it up to any questions.
Representative Johnson, comments, questions?
We could be here a long time. I'll start with shared services, I guess. Representative Buckley, you mentioned that there was an agreement, I guess, in at least identifying the areas in question, correct? You mentioned seven. But as we hear from Senator Girard, there's varying degrees of participation in those seven. Could you maybe just elaborate a bit? I mean, what are the three, let's say, that seem to be the easiest for everybody to agree and to stay in the pool, if you will, so that there is some shared services there?
Boy, do you want to take that one?
No, I'll leave that one here.
We could ask, actually.
And that's, we don't have to really get in the weeds on it.
From Senator Oregon, who worked on the report, and if you'd like Craig to come up, he'd be happy to.
I'm just wondering, what are the ones that have the least support amongst
the three that were agreed to by the University of Oregon were the three that were mandated by 270.
Okay.
Yes, right. That's correct.
And but I don't remember exactly what they were.
Before we get too far, go ahead and identify yourself.
Craig Morris, I'm the Vice President of Finance and Administration at Southern Oregon University. Thank you for having me up here. The three that U of O have opted into are the mandatory services, and they are risk management and the insurance pool. They are benefits and collective bargaining.
So, just to follow up then, so the lack of participation by the big three, if you will, is what leads to the $11 or $12 million shortfall that you're referring to that would be a cost shift from what the current status quo is onto...
That is correct.
Is that correct? Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of precipitated the crisis, especially with retirement and some...
Sure, I get that.
If I comment further, Mr. Chair, too, another aspect that has added to the financial woes is a change the university system's done on accounting, on how they handle student debt, how they carry student debt. It's an understandable change, but the timing of it, I have to say, is horrific. At the same time, you have a little bit of a drop in enrollment at both Eastern and Southern, and they're trying to keep their balance. This accounting change kind of took the feet out from under both institutions as well by not being allowed to carry student debt over as they had been on their mm-hmm. books previously. All of a sudden, in SOU's case, what looked like an ending reserve basically disappeared because they no longer had it. And this is a one-time shift that is happening, but it is a factor in what's going on right now.
follow up?
Well, that obviously was one of the fears that we had, those of us that worked on Senate Bill 270, i.e., you know, if we provide this autonomy and freedom over here, we really don't want to have a net negative impact on the true, as you call them now, not just the regionals, but the true. And, you know, obviously it's something that we need to confront, but I think it's those of us that worked on that bill, you know, in good faith, you know, really were wanting to be concerned with the welfare, the economic welfare of our regionals, because it's vital. We can't, you know, we can't strap them further than they already are at this current time. So I take that very seriously. So I appreciate you bringing that forward.
I appreciate, Representative, Mr. Chair, I appreciate those comments, and I fully agree with them, and I appreciate the concern that people have shown. Again, I think given the size of the total budget, particularly if we are in a point now, and I think the work we've done as a legislature to try to hold down health care costs, try to hold down public safety costs, so we can start to reinvest in education, I think that work has put us in a position to begin to reinvest in higher education as well, which should give us the ability to make shifts in the funding formula, or shifts in terms of the distribution when the comment being made about a funding model that had a baseline for each institution. That baseline can be set with those differences in shared services, sure. And it can change as the opt-in and opt-out happens. But the key thing is setting that baseline for all seven institutions so they know that what they have to work with. And I'm doing this without warning, but I'm going to quote the quote Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said that nothing great's ever accomplished without enthusiasm. And I have to tell you, number one, there's no enthusiasm from the Southern Oregon community to become an affiliate or branch campus. There's tremendous enthusiasm to have a chance to dictate our own destiny. There is enthusiasm that can come from sustainability. With K-12, and you all heard it in your districts during the last campaign, you hear it all the time, if we can get our districts, our school districts, to a level of sustainability and even start to reinvest, what we release there, the creativity, the energy released there is remarkable, and we get remarkable results. Same thing with our seven institutions. We have incredible people at all seven institutions. Let's try something. Let's try to get them to a point of sustainability, a baseline that they can count on for 5 years. And then let's start to reinvest as well in the idea of outcome-based. It makes sense to me. But sustainability and some reinvestment, and let's let them go. Let's them get out of the situation where they're constantly in cutback mode and get back to the mode of actually building programs again. And I have great confidence in their ability to do something that we'll all be enthusiastic about.
I'd like to weigh in, too. Another part of the solution, I told you about the funding formula being critical. I also believe very strongly that the HEC is going to put out a budget. I mean, we've authorized them to put out a budget. I don't want a lump sum. What I want is seven universities separated out so that we, and it might increase, it might make it more political. But on the other hand, there are times and there are exceptions, and we might have to, if there is a bad actor or two, we might have to cut some money from them and give it to somebody else. So I do believe that that's important as well as the funding formula.
In your discussions, were your understanding, because my comments early in the 2013 session with the Big Three, and there are folks in the room today that I had the conversation with, I said, in supporting Senate Bill 270, I want to warn you that you may not be able to walk away from any number of shared services. And for me to support 270, you have to understand, Big Three, you're going to have to be at the table and figure this out. In the conversations you've had, what is the sense of the feeling of autonomy that the Big Three have in this conversation?
I think some have done better than others, but I think it just goes to the number of shared services that have been agreed to by the Big Three. Oregon State has gone with 6 out of 7. University of Oregon has gone with 3 out of 7. And that, to me, has been a tremendous disappointment because they were the moving force for 270. And I was given assurances, I don't know about you, but a lot of us were given assurances that shared services would not be a problem. But they have become a problem. So to the tune of $11-12 million, which has precipitated the problems with Southern and with Eastern. So I'm just disappointed with the fact that maybe we should have taken more time with 270 to work out the shared services part of it, and now it's become kind of a problem. But again, if we go to how we fund it, you know, if they're out $12 million, then we can do a little shifting if the schools are broken out separately in the budget. So it gives us a little bit more freedom to do that.
And if I could add on, thanks, Senator, and Mr. Chair, I agree. If you take a look at what we do in K-12, we wrestle with the funding form of the K-12. But right now, for instance, on the poverty issue, you know, how do we judge poverty for school districts? That's a discussion that we have to have. And I echo Senator Girard's comments. We have to have that same conversation with our seven universities. We have to be able to say there are some areas that might need additional funding because of specific needs the state's trying to accomplish. For instance, SOU and Eastern both have a majority of their students are first-generation students. For SOU, 61% of their students are the first member of their family to attend higher education. So we have problems with retention rates at both Eastern and Southern because we have a very high percentage of first-generation students. They don't have a role model of how you make it through. They don't have that kind of support. So as an outcome, we might look at, wow, what if we fund specific retention programs for first-generation students at institutions that have that population and could use that support? But having that clarified by the HEC and brought forward to the legislature as far as the governor's budget is a process that I'm looking forward to.
Well, we knew there were going to be challenges as we passed Senate Bill 270 and had the discussion on the shared services, and being vice chair of this committee, and $5 will get you a latte most places, and so that may be the weight of what my concerns and stern talks, you know, the weight of what they carried. But again, I was very explicit with everybody that this discussion would be had, and there would probably be shared sacrifices with the shared services, but I wouldn't stand by and let the regionals or the trues suffer from the decisions of the big three, and I still stand firm with that. We need to figure out the right path for everybody. So thank you for the tough work, and I encourage you in that, Representative.
So OSU's agreed to 6 of the 7.
That's correct.
And what is the rationale for OSU to be able to get there and U of O not to be able to get there? Is there a simple answer to that question?
Actually, I can't. I will. I heard it has to do with bonding, and University of Oregon is concerned about bonding. Mm-hmm. It interferes with their ability to bond. Oregon State doesn't appear to have that concern. When we created 270, you can't really fault University of Oregon for doing what they're doing, even though it bothers me, because they're doing what's best for their university. And we've always made the point, what's best for your university might not be what's best for the system, and hence the problem. So I think you just have some people that are a little better players. Now, in the affiliation model with Oregon State, the reason Oregon State was chosen is their online abilities far surpass anybody else in the state, and also that they have played a little better with the regionals than has anybody else in the big three. So you know, I think if they were to pick who they had to go with, if that would be where they would want to go. But again, we have a long ways to go. These two models are a long ways apart, and we'll just have to see what the fallout's going to be.
Follow up. And I'm a U of O alum, and I still have issues with what they have stated as their needs. But I don't even get to the point of a latte with $5 with my opinions, just so you know. But I want to reiterate what the chair said. We cannot let the trues, especially Southern and Eastern, suffer because of this. We have to find, as I think you guys would agree, we have to find a way to fix that. It's all well and good for U of O and OSU and PSU to go off and do things that are best for them, but we also still don't want to lose what we've had with that unified system of OUS. So, anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair.
you talked a couple of times about bonding and in ways and means, and I think in this committee we had a number of bonding discussions in 2013, and I also expressed my interest in, even though there would be institutional boards and a lot of autonomy, that I was not really thrilled about any institution coming out from under some oversight of the treasurer's office. Where did we end up on that?
Pretty much we're still in line with your concerns, Mr. Chair. The ability of U of O is a large institution, I think, that can take on the bonding capacity on its own. If they create an endowment which has been promised of $2.5 billion, they will have assets that they will be able to bond against at a level that the other institutions will not be. One of the reasons the consortium idea makes sense, the part of the hybrid makes sense, is if you take the enrollment of the four TRUs, it's over 20,000 students. It's almost the size of PSU, or you know, it's in that neighborhood of the big three. Together, they can conceivably look at bonding, but state supervision will still be required. I don't think they're going to be able to do F bonds any longer. They're not going to be able to do student-backed, tuition fee-backed bonds, because they won't have the scale to do that. So that is something I believe, and correct me if I'm mistaken on that, but it's, I believe that tool will no longer be available to the smaller institutions.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to say, address two things. I was very reluctant to support 270 because it was my view that the fate of the big three should be integrated with the discussions of the fate of the TRUs. That we solve this problem without solving the other problem, we've created a much bigger problem. And I think it was, and I argued over and over, that it was really premature to do this. So now we're stuck with this problem. The issue of funding remains a very critical part of it, and I've had the dubious distinction of voting against a higher ed budget. I think every one of my, except maybe one, for the last 12 years. It's abysmal. I mean, it doesn't matter how you divide up the pie's not big enough. And until we get that pie big enough to support the aspirations we have for being a part of a world-class society, it doesn't matter how we cut it up. Everybody's going to get hungry, particularly now the regionals are, who we've managed to create a kind of orphan set of institutions. And I would favor putting all our emphasis on trying to get enough money into that system and then trying to figure out a better way to distribute it. But I don't think the problem is how we distribute it. I think the problem is we just have starved our institutions of higher education, and it's damn well time we stop doing that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you find a question in there, I would recommend you answer it.
Mr. Chair, if I can run just very briefly, thank you for your patience on it. And I totally understand and respect Senator Greenlee's comments. I agree with them. And I can't remember you ever voting. I don't know if you voted for one budget. I never saw you vote for a higher ed budget. Never voted for one of mine, I can tell you that. But
of course not.
but what I can offer is that there is, I'd encourage people to take the time to actually look at the budget materials presented by the TRUs. Mm-hmm. We have people that are working tremendously hard to set a foundation for institutions, even though we have disinvested. And I believe that all four institutions have viable plans of how to move forward. SOU, for instance, has done a worst case, middle case, best case scenario. And their best case scenario is such a meager investment by the state. They're all based on the possibility that we actually invest 3% more in higher ed in 15-17. The state budget, if the forecast is correct, we will be have a state budget that will be close to 9% larger in 15-17, and it just makes no sense to me why we would only give 3% to higher ed. So I would encourage you to look at the budget materials from the four institutions. I believe they all have viable plans. Look at what we've done in terms of the work that you've done and others in healthcare. Look what we've done in public safety. I think we've positioned ourselves well, and if this is part of the revenue reform discussion in 2015, to actually make an investment in higher education. If we can accomplish that, I'm very confident that the TRUs will thrive. They have the chance to thrive. So I'm optimistic.
One thing I'd like to bring up is, under both of these scenarios, there is cost savings. The State Board of Higher Ed would probably dissipate, and the Chancellor's Office would probably be terminated as well. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
So there is cost savings there that would help, that we could directly put into the four regionals.
And speaking of that, we've got Dr. Golden and Dr. Rose here. If we have questions specific to them, if they'd be willing to come up too. So keep that in mind. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I guess, is related to governance. And the question is, how do we get ourselves from where we are today to where we will need to be to have the issues worked out? I was here for the process of putting together Senate Bill 242, and that involved a great deal of interim work. That bill was worked on all during the 2011 session. I think we got the dash 26 amendments on that bill. A lot of work, a lot of time. I was here for the last session with Senate Bill 270. Again, we had extensive work in the interim. Victoria, what do you have, 12 or 14 meetings of that special committee? Every 2 weeks we met during the interim. Worked on it all session long. It popped out in June, and we passed the bill. This is a big topic here also. February is not the type of session, typically, as Senator Girard would say, to take up a hot potato. And this, I think, could be and perhaps is, but the question is, your committee is still meeting. You see yourselves coming up with a recommendation that you can agree on, and will that become then a bill draft, or will the recommendation be forwarded to either this committee that we then would work on trying to put something together, or just how do you see going forward to the place that we can actually get somewhere prior to the end of February?
I hate to bust the bubble, but we don't have bill drafting authority in this committee. So ours would be giving your committee and the Senate committee a recommendation as to how to move forward.
Okay.
I think the committee really has gone through a lot of information. And like I said, we've come up with a lot of different ideas. There are a tremendous number of models that have been proposed. From what I would gather right now is it really boils down to, I'd say Representative Buckley likes the hybrid model. I think some of us in the Senate would prefer the affiliation model. So it has come down to those two models. And I think both of them are very viable, and it needs to be discussed as to which direction to go in. As far as fixing the problem, it really does come down to funding. And we give 53% to education, which to me is quite a bit of money. And I'm not trying to pick winners and losers, but a little bit from K-12 would make a heck of a difference in higher ed and community colleges, which we haven't even discussed, are terribly underfunded as well. So some of it's going to be funding, some of it's going to be restructuring, and some of it's going to be the distribution formula and that sort of thing.
Very brief, Mr. Chair, in answer to Representative Johnson's question, I do think it's possible that because of the work that's been done in 270, because of the work that's been done since even the session has ended in terms of clarifying different models and also clarifying shared services and what the finances are, I think we do have a possibility in February of moving forward on a framework if we can get to an agreement. If there's a compromise somehow between where the Senate is and where the House seems to be in terms of the hybrid or the affiliate, is there a way to move forward with a trial run of a hybrid and a study of how an affiliate would work at the same time? I mean, there might be something in there, and I look forward to discussions that are taking place in the building this week. Hopefully by Friday we'll be able to have a discussion in our committee that talks about some practical steps we might be able to do in February, and then communicate that back to this committee. And as Senator Girard said, it will be your bill introduction, and we look forward to working with each one of you on it as we move forward.
Rep. Gilling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here, and thank you for your professorial outfit. I want to just pick up a little bit more with what Representative Johnson was asking. I don't know how many times you all have met, and you make a reference to a meeting coming up. This bill draft in front of us, specifically says that they will consult with you, meaning they, meaning the heck. And I assume that's what you meant by what the heck. Just a little more about the coordination that you see going forward. And I don't know, this bill does not prescribe who's going to be on the work group. We already have the special committee group.
I think I need to make, the bill draft is supposed to be a placeholder, bill.
There's nothing in that is
there's no intention of having another work group.
Yeah, correct? Thank you.
Yeah.
So, there is none.
No.
Well, thank you for distributing this.
We felt it was the least we could do for you.
And then the last part is we talk about funding, and I get that. You know, it's all about, we got to have the money. We've got the co-chair of the Ways and Means right here. Where's it going to come from?
Obviously, legislative salaries represent that.
Well, that'll fund a nice program.
I do think, again, given the work that's been done, if we can hold healthcare costs to a below 4% increase, if we can do that, we've committed to do that. If we can hold public safety costs, if we can cap prison population as we did in the 2013 session, going forward, if we can hold down those costs, 93% of the budget is public safety, it's human services, and it's education. And Senator Rudd talked about the percentage education gets. Education has to increase its percentage of the state budget if we are going to do this. Plus, I believe the revenue discussions, as painful as they are, that have been at least promoted for 2015. I was greatly, one of the things about special session, when the major business groups of our state came forward and testified in favor of tax increases. They weren't huge, but they testified in favor of the package to try to move the state forward. And they've expressed their willingness to participate in the discussion on revenue. And I think their motivation is higher education. I do believe community colleges and the universities are their motivation to look at the revenue reform. So that is where it's going to have to come from. Continue to work on the budget as a whole and look at revenue restructuring that will give us a chance to do what has been talked about, set a baseline that's sustainable for all seven institutions, and then invest in targeted places where we can actually make a difference.
Thank you for that. I would say one follow-up, if I might. Not related to that completely, but I am mystified by my senator's comment that he's for a hybrid that would be somewhat like Berkeley. And I wonder how an undergraduate would even know how to dress on a campus. It would be Lycra and Birkenstocks.
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Dr. Rose, before we close things, did you have some comments? Possibly, would you like to come forward or just... Why don't you come right on up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate the update. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Huffman and members of the committee, I'm Melody Rose, for the record, Interim Chancellor of the Oregon University System. Thank you for inviting me to the podium. There are just a few things I would touch on to augment what your colleagues have offered this morning. One is that I think there's a national context in which we need to set the financial duress that we find ourselves in, and I just would draw a slightly broader picture for you. Too oftentimes, I think we suspect that the challenges that we're facing here at home are somehow unique or the consequence of very unique circumstances here in our home state. There was a wonderful Moody's report issued in August of this last year that predicted the kind of stress that we're seeing some of our campuses are facing today, and they predict continued downward pressure on these campuses. So important to recognize that while there may be some homegrown challenges and some homegrown solutions, we're operating within a national economic context, which essentially predicts that we will have continued pressures on smaller public regional universities. And the reasons are pretty clear. It's because they have fewer revenue streams than our larger institutions that draw on philanthropy and research revenues. And it's also because when the economy improves, we generally see nationwide enrollment soften at campuses like theirs. So very predictably, that's where we find ourselves. And I have a slightly different take than Representative Buckley on the pressures that Southern is facing and how we might resolve them. And he and I have had spirited discussions and will continue to do so. But I would suggest to you that the financial pressures that several of our campuses are facing can be resolved. We are working very diligently with our colleagues at Southern and at Eastern. If you were to track my travel, you'll find I'm often in Ashland and in LeGrand, and so are my colleagues. And one of the things we're very keen to do is to resolve the financial stresses that those campuses are facing so that the governance conversation can continue apace. So I would actually encourage this body to decouple the issues of financial stress from governance models. And I would further stress that it might be worth your consideration to essentially confront the issue of the concept, the structure of shared services. That's the report that Representative Buckley referenced for you. There is unanimity in terms of structure. I doubt you will find presidential unanimity on how to pay for said structure. So I would encourage this body to really consider allowing the governance conversation to evolve thoughtfully and deliberately as we have done. Resolve those issues before resolving financing of shared services, because they're connected, as you might imagine. If you end up, as Representative Buckley suggests, with one possibility of a consortium, you may choose to fund shared services in one way. If, on the other hand, we end up with seven institutional boards, likely you would want a different funding model for shared services based on that governance structure. So my humble counsel would be to consider these things a little bit separately.
Thank you.
Happy to take any questions. We covered a lot of ground this morning, so I made a lot of notes, but I realize we're against the press of time, and I'm happy to answer any questions on other subjects that you raised.
I see none. Thank you. Appreciate your willingness to come up. All righty. Going to close the informational hearing on LC 171. And if there is nothing further for the good of the order, I see nothing, we are adjourned. We are adjourned.